Serafina Pekela called to the aeronaut and he woke at once, groggy with cold, but aware from the movement of the basket that something was wrong. It was swinging wildly as strong winds buffeted the gas bag, and the witches pulling the rope were barely managing to hold it. If they let go, the balloon would be swept off course at once, and to judge by his glance at the compass, would be swept towards Nova Zembla at nearly 100 miles an hour.
"Where are we?"
Lyra heard him call. She was half waking herself, uneasy because of the motion, and so cold that every part of her body was numb. She couldn't hear the witch's reply, but through her half-closed hood she saw, in the light of an Anbaric lantern, Lee Scoresby hold onto a strut and pull at a rope leading up into the gas bag itself. He gave a sharp tug as if against some obstruction, and looked up into the buffeting dark before looping the rope around a cleat on the suspension ring.
"I'm letting out some gas,"
he shouted to Serafina Pekela.
"We'll go down, we're way too high."
The witch called something in return, but again Lyra couldn't hear it. Roger was waking too. The creaking of the basket was enough to wake the deepest sleeper, never mind the rocking and bumping. Roger's demon and Pantaliban clung together like marmosets, and Lyra concentrated on lying still and not leaping up in fear.
"Sure, right,"
Roger said, sounding much more cheerful than she was.
"Soon as we get down, we can make a fire and get warm. I got some matches in me pocket. I pinched them out the kitchen at Bolvanger."
The balloon was certainly descending because they were enveloped a second later in thick, freezing cloud. Scraps and wisps of it flew through the basket, and then everything was obscured all at once. It was like the thickest fog Lyra had ever known. After a moment or two, there came another cry from Serafina Pekela, and the aeronaut unlooped the rope from the cleat and let go. It sprang upwards through his hands, and even over the creak and the buffeting and the howl of wind through the rigging, Lyra heard or felt a mighty thump from somewhere far above. Lee Scoresby saw her wide eyes.
"That's the gas valve! It works on a spring to hold the gas in. When I pull it down, some gas escapes out of the top, and we lose buoyancy and go down."
"Are we nearly?"
She didn't finish because something hideous happened. A creature half the size of a man with leathery wings and hooked claws was crawling over the side of the basket towards Lee Scoresby. It had a flat head with bulging eyes and a wide frog mouth, and from it came wafts of abominable stink. Lyra had no time to scream even before Yorick Bernison reached up and cuffed it away. It fell out of the basket and vanished with a shriek.
"Cliffgast,"
said Yorick briefly. The next moment Serafina Pekela appeared and clung to the side of the basket, speaking urgently.
"The cliffgasts are attacking. We'll bring the balloon to the ground, and then we must defend ourselves. They're..."
But Lyra didn't hear the rest of what she said, because there was a rending, ripping sound and everything tilted sideways. Then a terrific blow hurled the three humans against the side of the balloon where Yorick Bernison's armor was stacked. Yorick put out a great paw to hold them in because the basket was jolting so violently. Serafina Pekela had vanished. The noise was appalling. Over every other sound there came the shrieking of the cliff ghasts, and Lyra saw them hurtling past and smelled their foul stench. Then there came another jerk, so sudden that it threw them all to the floor again, and the basket began to sink with frightening speed, spinning all the while. It felt as if they had torn loose from the balloon and were dropping unchecked by anything. And then came another series of jerks and crashes, the basket being tossed rapidly from side to side as if they were bouncing between rock walls. The last thing Lyra saw was Lee Scoresby firing his long-barreled pistol directly in the face of a cliff ghast, and then she shut her eyes tight and clung to Yorick Bernison's fur with passionate fear. Howls, shrieks, the lash and whistle of the wind, the creak of the basket like a tormented animal, all filled the wild air with hideous noise. Then came the biggest jolt of all, and she found herself hurled out altogether. Her grip was torn loose, and all the breath was knocked out of her lungs as she landed in such a tangle that she couldn't tell which way was up, and her face and the tight-pulled hood was full of powder, dry, cold, crystals. It was snow. She had landed in a snowdrift. She was so battered that she could hardly think. She lay quite still for several seconds before feebly spitting out the snow in her mouth, and then she blew just as feebly until there was a little space to breathe in. Nothing seemed to be hurting in particular. She just felt utterly breathless. Cautiously she tried to move hands, feet, arms, legs, and to raise her head. She could see very little because her hood was still filled with snow. With an effort, as if her hands weighed a ton each, she brushed it off and peered out. She saw a world of grey, of pale greys and dark greys and blacks, where fog drifts wandered like wraiths. The only sounds she could hear were the distant cries of the cliff ghasts high above and the crash of waves on rocks some way off.
"Yorick!"
she cried. Her voice was faint and shaky, and she tried again, but no one answered.
"Roger!"
Roger!
She called, with the same result. She might have been alone in the world, but of course she never was, and Pantalaimon crept out of her anorak as a mouse to keep her company.
I've checked the alethiometer, and it's all right. Nothing's broken.
We're lost, Pan. Did you see those cliff ghasts? And Mr. Scoresby shooting them? God help us if they come down here.
We better try and find the basket. Maybe.
We better not call out. I did just now, but maybe I better not in case they hear us. I wish I knew where we were.
We might not like it if we did. We might be at the bottom of a cliff with no way up, and the cliff ghasts at the top to see us where the fog clears.
She felt around once she had rested a few more minutes and found that she had landed in a gap between two ice-covered rocks. Freezing fog covered everything. To one side there was the crash of waves about 50 yards off, by the sound of it, and from high above there still came the shrieking of the cliff ghasts, though that seemed to be abating a little. She could see no more than 2 or 3 yards in the murk, and even Pantalaimon's owl eyes were helpless. She made her way painfully, slipping and sliding on the rough rocks, away from the waves and up the beach a little, and found nothing but rock and snow, and no sign of the balloon or any of the occupants.
They can't have all just vanished.
Pantalaimon prowled, cat-formed, a little further afield, and came across 4 heavy sandbags broken open, with the scattered sand already freezing hard.
Ballast! He must have slung them off to fly up again.
She swallowed hard to subdue the lump in her throat, or the fear in her breast, or both.
Oh, God, I'm frightened. I hope they're safe.
Pantalaimon came to her arms, and then, mouse-formed, crept into her hood where he couldn't be seen. She heard a noise, something scraping on rock, and turned to see what it was.
Yorick!
But she choked the word back unfinished, for it wasn't Yorick Birnison at all. It was a strange bear, clad in polished armour with the dew on it frozen into frost, and with a plume in his helmet. He stood still about 6 feet away, and she thought she really was finished. The bear opened his mouth and roared. An echo came back from the cliffs and stirred more shrieking from far above. Out of the fog came another bear and another. Lyra stood still, clenching her little human fists. The bears didn't move until the first one said,
"Your name?"
"Lyra."
"Where have you come from?"
"The sky."
"In a balloon?"
"Yes."
"Come with us. You are a prisoner. Move, now, quickly."
Weary and scared, Lyra began to stumble over the harsh and slippery rocks, following the bear, wondering how she could talk her way out of this. Chapter 19. Captivity. The bears took Lyra up a gully in the cliffs, where the fog lay even more thickly than on the shore. The cries of the cliff ghasts and the crash of the waves grew fainter as they climbed, and presently the only sound was the ceaseless crying of seabirds. They clambered in silence over rocks and snowdrifts, and although Lyra peered wide-eyed into the enfolding greyness and strained her ears for the sound of her friends, she might have been the only human on Svalbard, and Yorick might have been dead. The bear sergeant said nothing to her until they were on level ground. There they stopped. From the sound of the waves, Lyra judged them to have reached the top of the cliffs, and she dared not run away in case she fell over the edge.
"Look up,"
said the bear, as a waft of breeze moved aside the heavy curtain of the fog. There was little daylight in any case, but Lyra did look, and found herself standing in front of a vast building of stone. It was as tall at least as the highest part of Jordan College, but much more massive, and carved all over with representations of warfare, showing bears victorious and skraelings surrendering, showing Tartars chained and slaving in the fire mines, showing zeppelins flying from all parts of the world bearing gifts and tributes to the king of the bears, Jofur Ragnarsson. At least, that was what the bear sergeant told her the carving showed. She had to take his word for it, because every projection and ledge on the deeply sculpted façade was occupied by gannets and skuas, which cawed and shrieked and wheeled constantly round overhead, and whose droppings had coated every part of the building with thick smears of dirty white. The bears seemed not to see the mess, however, and they led the way in through the huge arch, over the icy ground that was filthy with the spatter of the birds. There was a courtyard, and high steps and gateways, and at every point bears in armour challenged the incomers and were given a password. Their armour was polished and gleaming, and they all wore plumes in their helmets. Lyra couldn't help comparing every bear she saw with Yorick Birnison, and always to his advantage. He was more powerful, more graceful, and his armour was real armour, rust-coloured, blood-stained, dented with combat, not elegant, enamelled and decorative like most of what she saw around her now. As they went further in, the temperature rose, and so did something else. The smell in Yofur's palace was repulsive. Rancid seal fat, dung, blood, refuse of every sort. Lyra pushed back her hood to be cooler, but she couldn't help wrinkling her nose. She hoped bears couldn't read human expressions. There were iron brackets every few yards, holding blubber lamps, and in their flaring shadows it wasn't always easy to see where she was treading, either. Finally they stopped outside a heavy door of iron. A guard bear pulled back a massive bolt, and the sergeant suddenly swung his paw at Lyra, knocking her head over heels through the doorway. Before she could scramble up, she heard the door being bolted behind her. It was profoundly dark, but Pantalaimon became a firefly and shed a tiny glow around them. They were in a narrow cell where the walls dripped with damp, and there was one stone bench for furniture. In the farthest corner there was a heap of rags she took for bedding, and that was all she could see. Lyra sat down, with Pantalaimon on her shoulder, and felt in her clothes for the alethiometer.
It certainly had a lot of banging about, Pan. I hope it still works.
Pantalaimon flew down to her wrist and sat there glowing while Lyra composed her mind. With a part of her, she found it remarkable that she could sit here in terrible danger and yet sink into the calm she needed to read the alethiometer. And yet it was so much a part of her now that the most complicated questions sorted themselves out into their constituent symbols as naturally as her muscles moved her limbs. She hardly had to think about them. She turned the hands and thought the question,
"Where is Yorick?"
The answer came at once.
"A day's journey away, carried there by the balloon after your crash, but hurrying this way."
"And Roger?"
"With Yorick."
"What will Yorick do?"
"He intends to break into the palace and rescue you in the face of all the difficulties."
She put the alethiometer away, even more anxious than before.
"They won't let him, will they?"
she said to Pantalaimon.
"There's too many of him. I wish I was a witch, Pan. Then you could go off and find him and take messages and all, and we could make a proper plan."
Then she had the fright of her life. A man's voice spoke in the darkness a few feet away and said,
"Who are you?"
She leaped up with a cry of alarm. Pantalaimon became a bat at once, shrieking, and flew around her head as she backed against the wall.
"Eh? Eh? Who is that? Speak up! Speak up!"
"Be a firefly again, Pan, but don't go too close."
The little wavering point of light danced through the air and fluttered around the head of the speaker. And it hadn't been a heap of rags, after all. It was a grey-bearded man, chained to the wall, whose eyes glittered in Pantalaimon's luminance, and whose tattered hair hung over his shoulders. His demon, a weary-looking serpent, lay in his lap, flicking out her tongue occasionally as Pantalaimon flew near.
"What's your name?"
"Jotham Santelia. I am the Regius Professor of Cosmology at the University of Gloucester. Who are you?"
"Lyra Belacqua. What have they locked you up for?"
"Malice and jealousy. Where do you come from, eh?"
"From Jordan College."
"What? Oxford?"
"Yes."
"Is that scoundrel Trelawney still there, eh?"
"The Palmerian professor, yes."
"Is he, by God, eh? They should have forced his resignation long ago. Duplicitous plagiarist. Coxcomb."
Lyra made a neutral sound.
"Has he published his paper on gamma-ray photons yet?"
the professor said, thrusting his face up towards Lyra's. She moved back.
"I don't know,"
she said, and then, making it up out of pure habit,
"No, I remember now. He said he still needed to check some figures, and he said he was going to write about dust as well. That's it."
"Scoundrel! Thief! Blackguard! Rogue!"
shouted the old man, and he shook so violently that Lyra was afraid he'd have a fit. His demon slithered lethargically off his lap as the professor beat his fists against his shanks. Drops of saliva flew out of his mouth.
"Yeah, I always thought he was a thief, and a rogue and all that."
If it was unlikely for a scruffy little girl to turn up in his cell knowing the very man who figured in his obsessions, the Regius Professor didn't notice. He was mad, and no wonder, poor old man. But he might have some scraps of information that Lyra could use. She sat carefully near him, not near enough for him to touch, but near enough for Pantalaimon's tiny light to show him clearly.
"One thing Professor Trelawney used to boast about was how well he knew the King of the Bears."
"Boast? Eh? Eh? Well, I should say he boasts. He's nothing but a popinjay and a pirate. Not a scrap of original research to his name. Everything filched from better men."
"Yeah, that's right. And when he does do something of his own, he gets it wrong."
"Yes, yes. Absolutely. No talent, no imagination, a fraud from top to bottom.
I mean, for example, I bet you know more about the bears than he does for a start.
Bears? Oh, I could write a treatise on them. That's why they shut me away, you know.
Why is that?
I know too much about them. And they daren't kill me. Oh, they daren't do it, much as they'd like to. I know, you see. I have friends. Yes, powerful friends.
Yeah, and I bet you'd be a wonderful teacher, being as you've got so much knowledge and experience.
Even in the depths of his madness, a little common sense still flickered, and he looked at her sharply, almost as if he suspected her of sarcasm. But she had been dealing with suspicious and cranky scholars all her life, and she gazed back with such bland admiration that he was soothed.
Teacher! Teacher! Yes, I could teach. Give me the right pupil, and I will light a fire in his mind.
Because your knowledge ought not to just vanish. It ought to be passed on so people remember you.
Yes,
he said, nodding seriously.
That's very perceptive of you, child. What is your name?
Lyra, could you teach me about the bears?
The bears?
I'd really like to know about cosmology and dust and all, but I'm not clever enough for that. You need really clever students for that. But I could learn about the bears. You could teach me about them, all right. And we could sort of practice on that and work up to dust, maybe.
Yes, yes. I believe you're right. There is a correspondence between the microcosm and the macrocosm. The stars are alive, child. Did you know that? Everything out there is alive. And there are grand purposes abroad. The universe is full of intentions, you know. Everything happens for a purpose. Your purpose is to remind me of that. Good, good. In my despair, I had forgotten. Good. Excellent, my child.
So, have you seen the king, Jofur Ragnarsson?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I came here at his invitation, you know. He intended to set up a university. He was going to make me vice-chancellor. That put me one in the eye for the Royal Arctic Institute. Eh? Eh? And that scoundrel Trelawney. Ha!
What happened?
I was betrayed by lesser men. Trelawney among them, of course. He was here, you know, on Svalbard. Spread lies and calumny about my qualifications. Calumny! Slander! Who was it discovered the final proof of the Barnard-Stokes hypothesis? Eh? Eh? Yes, Santelia, that's who. Trelawney couldn't take it. Lied through his teeth. Jofur Ragnarsson had me thrown in here. Oh, I'll be out one day, you'll see. I'll be vice-chancellor. Oh, yes. Let Trelawney come to me then, begging for mercy. Let the Publications Committee of the Royal Arctic Institute spurn my contributions then. Ha! I'll expose them all.
I expect Jorik Bernason will believe you when he comes back.
Jorik Bernason? No good waiting for that. He'll never come back.
He's on his way now.
Then they'll kill him. He's not a bear, you see. He's an outcast, like me. Degraded, you see. Not entitled to any of the privileges of a bear.
Supposing Jorik Bernason did come back, though. Supposing he challenged Jofur Ragnarsson to a fight.
Oh, they wouldn't allow it. Jofur would never lower himself to acknowledge Jorik Bernason's right to fight him. Hasn't got a right. Jorik might as well be a seal now, or a walrus, not a bear. Or worse, Tartar, or Skraeling. They wouldn't fight him honourably like a bear. They'd kill him with fire hurlers before he got near. Not a hope. No mercy.
Oh,
said Lyra with a heavy despair in her breast.
And what about the bear's other prisoners? Do you know where they keep them?
Other prisoners?
Like Lord Asriel.
Suddenly the professor's manner changed altogether. He cringed and shrank back against the wall and shook his head warningly.
Shh! Quiet! They'll hear you!
Why mustn't we mention Lord Asriel?
Forbidden! Very dangerous! Jofur Ragnarsson will not allow him to be mentioned.
Why?
Lyra said, coming closer and whispering herself so as not to alarm him.
Keeping Lord Asriel prisoner is a special charge laid on Jofur by the Oblation Board. Mrs. Coulter herself came here to see Yorfer and offered him all kinds of rewards to keep Lord Asriel out of the way. I know about it, you see, because at the time I was in Yorfer's favour myself. I met Mrs. Coulter, yes, had a long conversation with her. Yorfer was besotted with her, couldn't stop talking about her, would do anything for her. If she wants Lord Asriel kept 100 miles away, that's what will happen. Anything for Mrs. Coulter, anything. He's going to name his capital city after her. Did you know that?
So he wouldn't let anyone go and see Lord Asriel?
No, never. But he's afraid of Lord Asriel too, you know. Yorfer's playing a difficult game. But he's clever. He's done what they both want. He's kept Lord Asriel isolated to please Mrs. Coulter. And he's let Lord Asriel have all the equipment he wants to please him. Oh, can't last. This equilibrium. Unstable. Pleasing both sides, eh? The wave function of this situation is going to collapse quite soon. I have it on good authority.
Really?
Said Lyra, her mind elsewhere, furiously thinking about what he'd just said.
Yes. My demon's tongue can taste probability, you know.
Yeah, mine too. When do they feed us, Professor?
Feed us?
Well, they must put some food in sometime, else we'd starve. And there's bones on the floor. I expect they're seal bones, aren't they?
Seal? I don't know. It might be.
Lyra got up and felt her way to the door. There was no handle, naturally, and no keyhole, and it fitted so closely at top and bottom that no light showed. She pressed her ear to it, but heard nothing. Behind her, the old man was muttering to himself. She heard his chain rattle as he turned over wearily and lay the other way, and presently he began to snore. She felt her way back to the bench. Pantalaimon, tired of putting out light, had become a bat, which was all very well for him. He fluttered around, squeaking quietly, while Lyra sat and chewed a fingernail. Quite suddenly, with no warning at all, she remembered what it was that she'd heard the Palmyrian professor saying in the retiring room all that time ago. Something had been nagging at her ever since Yorick Bernison had first mentioned Yoffo's name, and now it came back. What Yoffo Ragnarsson wanted more than anything else, Professor Trelawney had said, was a demon. Of course, she hadn't understood what he meant. He'd spoken of Panserbjörner instead of using the English word, so she didn't know he was talking about bears, and she had no idea that Yoffo Ragnarsson wasn't a man. And a man would have had a demon anyway, so it hadn't made sense. But now it was plain. Everything she'd heard about the Bear King added up. The mighty Yoffo Ragnarsson wanted nothing more than to be a human being, with a demon of his own. And as she thought that, a plan came to her, a way of making Yoffo Ragnarsson do what he would normally never have done. A way of restoring Yorick Bernison to his rightful throne. A way, finally, of getting to the place where they had put Lord Asriel and taking him the alethiometer. The idea hovered and shimmered delicately like a soap bubble, and she dared not even look at it directly in case it burst. But she was familiar with the way of ideas, and she let it shimmer, looking away, thinking about something else. She was nearly asleep when the bolts clattered and the door opened. Light spilled in, and she was on her feet at once, with Pantalaimon hidden swiftly in her pocket. As soon as the bear guard bent his head to lift the haunch of seal meat and throw it in, she was at his side, saying,
"Take me to Yoffo Ragnarsson. You'll be in trouble if you don't. It's very urgent."
He dropped the meat from his jaws and looked up. It wasn't easy to read Bear's expressions, but he looked angry.
"It's about Yorick Bernison. I know something about him, and the king needs to know."
"Tell me what it is, and I'll pass the message on."
"That wouldn't be right. Not for someone else to know before the king does. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but you see, it's the rule that the king has to know things first."
Perhaps he was slow-witted. At any rate, he paused and then threw the meat into the cell before saying,
"Very well. You come with me."
He led her out into the open air, for which she was grateful. The fog had lifted and there were stars glittering above the high-walled courtyard. The guard conferred with another bear who came to speak to her.
"You cannot see Yorfer Ragnarsson when you please. You have to wait till he wants to see you."
"But this is urgent, what I've got to tell him. It's about Yorick Bernison. I'm sure His Majesty would want to know it, but all the same I can't tell it to anyone else, don't you see? It wouldn't be polite. He'd be ever so cross if he knew we hadn't been polite."
That seemed to carry some weight, or else to mystify the bear sufficiently to make him pause. Lyra was sure her interpretation of things was right. Jofur Ragnarsson was introducing so many new ways that none of the bears was certain yet how to behave, and she could exploit this uncertainty in order to get to Jofur. So that bear retreated to consult the bear above him, and before long Lyra was ushered inside the palace again, but into the state quarters this time. It was no cleaner here, and in fact the air was even harder to breathe than in the cell, because all the natural stinks had been overlaid by a heavy layer of cloying perfume. She was made to wait in a corridor, then in an anteroom, then outside a large door, while bears discussed and argued and scurried back and forth, and she had time to look around at the preposterous decoration. The walls were rich with gilt plasterwork, some of which was already peeling off or crumbling with damp, and the florid carpets were trodden with filth. Finally, the large door was opened from the inside. A blaze of light from half a dozen chandeliers, a crimson carpet, and more of that thick perfume hanging in the air. And the faces of a dozen or more bears, all gazing at her, none in armour but each with some kind of decoration, a golden necklace, a headdress of purple feathers, a crimson sash. Curiously, the room was also occupied by birds. Terns and skuas perched on the plaster cornice and swooped low to snatch at bits of fish that had fallen out of one another's nests in the chandeliers. And on a dais at the far end of the room, a mighty throne reared up high. It was made of granite for strength and massiveness, but like so many other things in Jofur's palace, it was decorated with over-elaborate swags and festoons of gilt that looked like tinsel on a mountainside. Sitting on the throne was the biggest bear she had ever seen. Jofur Ragnarsson was even taller and bulkier than Yorick, and his face was much more mobile and expressive, with a kind of humanness in it which she had never seen in Yorick's. When Jofur looked at her, she seemed to see a man looking out of his eyes, the sort of man she had met at Mrs. Coulter's, a subtle politician used to power. He was wearing a heavy gold chain around his neck, with a gaudy jewel hanging from it, and his claws, a good 6 inches long, were each covered in gold leaf. The effect was one of enormous strength and energy and craft. He was quite big enough to carry the absurd over-decoration. On him it didn't look preposterous, it looked barbaric and magnificent. She quailed. Suddenly her idea seemed too feeble for words. But she moved a little closer because she had to, and then she saw that Jofur was holding something on his knee, as a human might let a cat sit there, or a demon. It was a big stuffed doll, a mannequin with a vacant, stupid human face. It was dressed as Mrs. Coulter would dress, and it had a sort of rough resemblance to her. He was pretending he had a demon. Then she knew she was safe. She moved up close to the throne and bowed very low, with Pantalaimon keeping quiet and still in her pocket.
Our greetings to you, great king. Or, I mean, my greetings, not his.
Not whose?
He said, and his voice was lighter than she had thought it would be, but full of expressive tones and subtleties. When he spoke, he waved a paw in front of his mouth to dislodge the flies that clustered there.
Yorick Bernison's, your majesty. I've got something very important and secret to tell you, and I think I ought to tell you in private, really.
Something about Yorick Bernison?
She came close to him, stepping carefully over the bird-spattered floor, and brushed away the flies buzzing at her face.
Something about demons,
she said, so that only he could hear. His expression changed. She couldn't read what it was saying, but there was no doubt that he was powerfully interested. Suddenly he lumbered forward off the throne, making her skip aside, and roared an order to the other bears. They all bowed their heads and backed out towards the door. The birds, which had risen in a flurry at his roar, squawked and swooped around overhead before settling again on their nests. When the throne room was empty but for Jofur Ragnarsson and Lyra, he turned to her eagerly.
Well, tell me who you are. What is this about demons?
I am a demon, your majesty.
He stopped still.
Whose?
Yorick Bernison's.
It was the most dangerous thing she had ever said. She could see quite clearly that only his astonishment prevented him from killing her at once. She went on.
Please, your majesty, let me tell you all about it first, before you harm me. I've come here at my own risk, as you can see, and there's nothing I've got that could hurt you. In fact, I want to help you. That's why I've come. Yorick Bernison was the first bear to get a demon, but it should have been you. I would much rather be your demon than his. That's why I came.
How? How has a bear got a demon? And why him? And how are you so far from him?
The flies left his mouth like tiny words.
That's easy. I can go far from him because I'm like a witch's demon. You know how they can go hundreds of miles from their humans? It's like that. And as for how he got me, it was at Bolvanger. You've heard of Bolvanger because Mrs. Coulter must have told you about it, but she probably didn't tell you everything they were doing there.
Cutting?
Yes, cutting. That's part of it. Intercision. But they're doing all kinds of other things too, like making artificial demons and experimenting on animals. When Yorick Bernerson heard about it, he offered himself for an experiment to see if they could make a demon for him, and they did. It was me. My name is Lyra. Just like when people have demons, they're animal-formed. So when a bear has a demon, it'll be human. And I'm his demon. I can see into his mind and know exactly what he's doing and where he is, and...
Where is he now?
On Svalbard. He's coming this way as fast as he can.
Why? What does he want? He must be mad. We'll tear him to pieces.
He wants me. He's coming to get me back. But I don't want to be his demon, Jofa Ragnarsson. I want to be yours. Because once they saw how powerful a bear was with a demon, the people at Bolvanger decided not to do that experiment ever again. Yorick Bernerson was going to be the only bear who ever had a demon. And with me helping him, he could lead all the bears against you. That's what he's come to Svalbard for.
The Bear King roared his anger. He roared so loudly that the crystal in the chandeliers tinkled and every bird in the great room shrieked and Lyra's ears rang. But she was equal to it.
That's why I love you best. Because you're passionate and strong as well as clever. And I just had to leave him and come and tell you because I don't want him ruling the bears. It ought to be you. And there is a way of taking me away from him and making me your demon. But you wouldn't know what it was unless I told you. And you might do the usual thing about fighting bears like him that have been outcast. I mean, not fight him properly, but kill him with fire hurlers or something. And if you did that, I'd just go out like a light and die with him.
But you, how can...
I can become your demon, but only if you defeat Yorick Bernerson in single combat. Then his strength will flow into you, and my mind will flow into yours, and we'll be like one person, thinking each other's thoughts. And you can send me miles away to spy for you, or keep me here by your side, whichever you like. And I'd help you lead the bears to capture Bolvanger if you like, and make them create more demons for your favourite bears. Or if you'd rather be the only bear with a demon, we could destroy Bolvanger forever. We could do anything, Jofa Ragnarsson. You and me together.
All the time she was holding Pantalaimon in her pocket with a trembling hand, and he was keeping as still as he could in the smallest mouse form he had ever assumed. Jofa Ragnarsson was pacing up and down with an air of explosive excitement.
Single combat? Me? I must fight Yorick Bernerson? Impossible. He is outcast. How can that be? How can I fight him? Is that the only way?
It's the only way,
said Lyra, wishing it were not, because Jofa Ragnarsson seemed bigger and more fierce every minute. Dearly as she loved Yorick and strong as her faith was in him, she couldn't really believe that he would ever beat this giant among giant bears. But it was the only hope they had. Being mown down from a distance by fire hurlers was no hope at all. Suddenly, Jofa Ragnarsson turned.
Prove it. Prove that you are a demon.
All right. I can do that easy. I can find out anything that you know and no one else does. Something that only a demon will be able to find out.
Then tell me, what was the first creature I killed?
I'll have to go into a room by myself to do this. When I'm your demon, you'll be able to see how I do it. But until then, it's got to be private.
There is an anteroom behind this one. Go into that and come out when you know the answer.
Lyra opened the door and found herself in a room lit by one torch, and empty but for a cabinet of mahogany containing some tarnished silver ornaments. She took out the alethiometer and asked,
"Where is Yorick now?"
4 hours away, and hurrying ever faster.
How can I tell him what I've done?
You must trust him.
She thought anxiously of how tired he would be. But then she reflected that she was not doing what the alethiometer had just told her to do. She wasn't trusting him. She put that thought aside and asked the question Jofur Ragnarsson wanted. What was the first creature he had killed? The answer came, Jofur's own father. She asked further and learned that Jofur had been alone on the ice as a young bear on his first hunting expedition and had come across a solitary bear. They had quarrelled and fought, and Jofur had killed him. This in itself would have been a crime, but it was worse than simple murder, for Jofur learned later that the other bear was his own father. Bears were brought up by their mothers and seldom saw their fathers. Naturally, Jofur concealed the truth of what he had done. No one knew about it but Jofur himself, and now Lyra knew as well. She put the alethiometer away and wondered how to tell him about it.
"Flatter him,"
whispered Pantalaimon.
"That's all he wants."
So Lyra opened the door and found Jofur Ragnarsson waiting for her, with an expression of triumph, slyness, apprehension, and greed.
"Well?"
She knelt down in front of him and bowed her head to touch his left forepaw, the stronger, for bears were left-handed.
"I beg your pardon, Jofur Ragnarsson. I didn't know you were so strong and great."
"What's this? Answer my question."
"The first creature you killed was your own father. I think you're a new god, Jofur Ragnarsson. That's what you must be. Only a god would have the strength to do that."
"You know. You can see."
"Yes, because I am a demon, like I said."
"Tell me one thing more. What did the Lady Coulter promise me when she was here?"
Once again, Lyra went into the empty room and consulted the alethiometer before returning with the answer.
"She promised you that she'd get the magisterium in Geneva to agree that you could be baptized as a Christian, even though you hadn't got a demon then. Well, I'm afraid she hasn't done that, Jofur Ragnarsson, and quite honestly, I don't think they'd ever agree to that if you didn't have a demon. I think she knew that, and she wasn't telling you the truth. But in any case, when you've got me as your demon, you could be baptized if you wanted to, because no one could argue then. You could demand it, and they wouldn't be able to turn you down."
"Yes, true. That's what she said. True, every word. And she has deceived me. I trusted her, and she deceived me."
"Yes, she did. But she doesn't matter anymore. Excuse me, Jofur Ragnarsson. I hope you won't mind me telling you, but Yorick Bernison's only 4 hours away now, and maybe you better tell your guard bears not to attack him as they normally would. If you're going to fight him for me, he'll have to be allowed to come to the palace."
"Yes."
"And maybe when he comes, I better pretend I still belong to him and say I got lost or something. He won't know. I'll pretend. Are you going to tell the other bears about me being Yorick's demon and then belonging to you when you beat him?"
"I don't know. What should I do?"
"I don't think you better mention it yet. Once we're together, you and me, we can think what's best to do and decide then. What you need to do now is explain to all the other bears why you're going to let Yorick fight you like a proper bear, even though he's an outcast. Because they won't understand, and we've got to find a reason for that. I mean, they'll do what you tell them anyway, but if they see the reason for it, they'll admire you even more."
"Yes. What should we tell them?"
Tell them that to make your kingdom completely secure, you've called Jorick Bernison here yourself to fight him, and the winner will rule over the bears forever. See, if you make it look like your idea that he's coming and not his, they'll be really impressed. They'll think you're able to call him here from far away. They'll think you can do anything."
"Yes."
The great bear was helpless. Lyra found her power over him almost intoxicating, and if Pantalaimon hadn't nipped her hand sharply to remind her of the danger they were all in, she might have lost all her sense of proportion. But she came to herself and stepped modestly back to watch and wait, as the bears, under Jofur's excited direction, prepared the combat ground for Yorick Birnison. And meanwhile, Yorick, knowing nothing about it, was hurrying ever closer towards what she wished she could tell him was a fight for his life. Chapter 20. Mortal Combat. Fights between bears were common, and the subject of much ritual. For a bear to kill another was rare, though, and when that happened it was usually by accident or when one bear mistook the signals from another, as in the case of Yorick Birnison. Cases of straightforward murder, like Yufur's killing of his own father, were rarer still. But occasionally there came circumstances in which the only way of settling a dispute was a fight to the death. And for that, a whole ceremonial was prescribed. As soon as Yufur announced that Yorick Birnison was on his way, and a combat would take place, the combat ground was swept and smoothed. Armourers came up from the fire mines to check Yofor's armour. Every rivet was examined, every link tested, and the plates were burnished with the finest sand. Just as much attention was paid to his claws. The gold leaf was rubbed off, and each separate 6-inch hook was sharpened and filed to a deadly point. Lyra watched with a growing sickness in the pit of her stomach, for Yorick Birnison wouldn't be having this attention. He had been marching over the ice for nearly 24 hours already without rest or food. He might have been injured in the crash, and she had let him in for this fight without his knowledge. At one point, after Yofur Ragnarsson had tested the sharpness of his claws on a fresh-killed walrus, slicing its skin open like paper, and the power of his crashing blows on the walrus's skull, 2 blows and it was cracked like an egg, Lyra had to make an excuse to Yofur and go away by herself to weep with fear. Even Pantaleimon, who could normally cheer her up, had little to say that was hopeful. All she could do was consult the alethiometer. "He is an hour away," it told her, and again, she must trust him. And, this was harder to read, she even thought it was rebuking her for asking the same question twice. By this time, word had spread among the bears, and every part of the combat ground was crowded. Bears of high rank had the best places, and there was a special enclosure for the she-bears, including, of course, Yofur's wives. Lyra was profoundly curious about she-bears, because she knew so little about them, but this was no time to wander about asking questions. Instead, she stayed close to Yofur Ragnarsson and watched the courtiers around him assert their rank over the common bears from outside, and tried to guess the meaning of the various plumes and badges and tokens they all seemed to wear. Some of the highest ranking, she saw, carried little mannequins like Yofur's ragdoll demon, trying to curry favour, perhaps, by imitating the fashion he'd begun. She was sardonically pleased to notice that when they saw that Yofur had discarded his, they didn't know what to do with theirs. Should they throw them away? Were they out of favour now? How should they behave? Because that was the prevailing mood in his court, she was beginning to see. They weren't sure what they were. They weren't like Yorick Birnison, pure and certain and absolute. There was a constant pall of uncertainty hanging over them as they watched one another and watched Yofur. And they watched her with open curiosity. She remained modestly close to Yofur and said nothing, lowering her eyes whenever a bear looked at her. The fog had lifted by this time, and the air was clear. And as chance would have it, the brief lifting of darkness towards noon coincided with the time Lyra thought Yorick was going to arrive. As she stood shivering on a little rise of dense-packed snow at the edge of the combat ground, she looked up towards the faint lightness in the sky and longed with all her heart to see a flight of ragged, elegant black shapes descending to bear her away, or to see the Aurora's hidden city where she would be able to walk safely along those broad boulevards in the sunlight, or to see Mark Costa's broad arms, to smell the friendly smells of flesh and cooking that enfolded you in her presence. She found herself crying, with tears that froze almost as soon as they formed and which she had to brush away painfully. She was so frightened. Bears who didn't cry couldn't understand what was happening to her. It was some human process, meaningless. And of course Pantaleimon couldn't comfort her as he normally would, though she kept her hand in her pocket firmly around his warm little mouse form, and he nuzzled at her fingers. Beside her, the smiths were making the final adjustments to Yofur Ragnarsson's armour. He reared like a great metal tower, shining in polished steel, the smooth plates inlaid with wires of gold. His helmet enclosed the upper part of his head in a glistening carapace of silver grey with deep eye slits, and the underside of his body was protected by a close-fitting sark of chain mail. It was when she saw this that Lyra realized that she had betrayed Yorick Birnison, for Yorick had nothing like it. His armor protected only his back and sides. She looked at Jofur Ragnarsson, so sleek and powerful, and felt a deep sickness in her, like guilt and fear combined.
"Excuse me, Your Majesty, if you remember what I said to you before."
Her shaking voice felt thin and weak in the air. Jofur Ragnarsson turned his mighty head, distracted from the target three bears were holding up in front for him to slash at with his perfect claws.
"Yes, yes."
"Remember, I said I'd better go and speak to Yorick Birnison first and pretend."
But before she could even finish her sentence, there was a roar from the bears on the watchtower. The others all knew what it meant and took it up with a triumphant excitement. They had seen Yorick.
"Please, I'll fool him. You'll see."
"Yes, yes. Go now. Go and encourage him."
Jofur Ragnarsson was hardly able to speak for rage and excitement. Lyra left his side and walked across the combat ground, bare and clear as it was, leaving her little footprints in the snow, and the bears on the far side parted to let her through. As their great bodies lumbered aside, the horizon opened, gloomy in the pallor of the light. Where was Yorick Birnison? She could see nothing, but then the watchtower was high and they could see what was still hidden from her. All she could do was walk forward in the snow. He saw her before she saw him. There was a bounding and a heavy clank of metal, and in a flurry of snow, Yorick Birnison stood beside her.
"Oh, Yorick, I've done a terrible thing. My dear, you're going to have to fight Jofur Ragnarsson. And you ain't ready. You're tired and hungry, and your armor's..."
"What terrible thing?"
"I told him you was coming, because I read it on the symbol reader, and he's desperate to be like a person and have a demon. Just desperate. So I tricked him into thinking that I was your demon, and I was going to desert you and be his instead. But he had to fight you to make it happen. Because otherwise, Yorick dear, they'd never let you fight. They were going to just burn you up before you got close."
"You tricked Jofur Ragnarsson?"
"Yes. I made him agree that he'd fight you instead of just killing you straight off like an outcast. And the winner would be King of the Bears. I had to do that because..."
"Belacqua. No, you are Lyra Silvertongue. To fight him is all I want. Come, little demon."
She looked at Yorick Birnison in his battered armor, lean and ferocious, and felt as if her heart would burst with pride. They walked together towards the massive hulk of Jofur's palace, where the combat ground lay flat and open at the foot of the walls. Bears clustered at the battlements, white faces filled every window, and their heavy forms stood like a dense wall of misty white ahead, marked with the black dots of eyes and noses. The nearest ones moved aside, making two lines for Yorick Birnison and his demon to walk between. Every bear's eyes were fixed on them. Yorick halted across the combat ground from Jofur Ragnarsson. The king came down from the rise of trodden snow, and the two bears faced each other, several yards apart. Lyra was so close to Yorick that she could feel a trembling in him like a great dynamo, generating mighty and barbaric forces. She touched him briefly on the neck at the edge of his helmet and said,
"Fight well, Yorick, my dear. You're the real king, and he ain't. He's nothing."
Then she stood back.
"Bears!"
Yorick Birnison roared. An echo rang back from the palace walls and startled birds out of their nests. He went on,
"The terms of this combat are these. If Jofur Ragnarsson kills me, then he will be king forever, safe from challenge or dispute. If I kill Jofur Ragnarsson, I shall be your king. My first order to you all will be to tear down that palace, that perfumed house of mockery and tinsel, and hurl the gold and marble into the sea. Iron is bare metal. Gold is not. Jofur Ragnarsson has polluted Svalbard. I have come to cleanse it. Jofur Ragnarsson, I challenge you."
Then Jofur bounded forward a step or two as if he could hardly hold himself back.
"Bears!"
he roared in his turn.
"Yorick Birnison has come back at my invitation. I drew him here. It is for me to make the terms of this combat. And they are these.
If I kill your Egbernison, his flesh shall be torn apart and scattered to the cliff ghasts. His head shall be displayed above my palace. His memory shall be obliterated. It shall be a capital crime to speak his name.
He continued, and then each bear spoke again. It was a formula, a ritual faithfully followed. Lyra looked at the two of them so utterly different. Yorfur so glossy and powerful, immense in his strength and health, splendidly armoured, proud and king-like. And Yorick smaller, though she had never thought he would look small, and poorly equipped, his armour rusty and dented. But his armour was his soul. He had made it, and it fitted him. They were one. Yorfur was not content with his armour. He wanted another soul as well. He was restless, while Yorick was still. And she was aware that all the other bears were making the comparison too. But Yorick and Yorfur were more than just two bears. There were two kinds of beardom opposed here, two futures, two destinies. Yorfur had begun to take them in one direction, and Yorick would take them in another. And in the same moment, one future would close forever as the other began to unfold. As their ritual combat moved towards the second phase, the two bears began to prowl restlessly on the snow, edging forwards, swinging their heads. There was not a flicker of movement from the spectators, but all eyes followed them. Finally, the warriors were still and silent, watching each other face to face across the width of the combat ground. Then, with a roar and a blur of snow, both bears moved at the same moment. Like two great masses of rock balanced on adjoining peaks and shaken loose by an earthquake, which bound down the mountainsides gathering speed, leaping over crevasses and knocking trees into splinters until they crash into each other so hard that both are smashed to powder and flying chips of stone. That was how the two bears came together. The crash as they met resounded in the still air and echoed back from the palace wall. But they weren't destroyed as rock would have been. They both fell aside, and the first to rise was Yorick. He twisted up in a lithe spring and grappled with Yorfur, whose armour had been damaged by the collision and who couldn't easily raise his head. Yorick made at once for the vulnerable gap at his neck. He raked the white fur and then hooked his claws beneath the edge of Yorfur's helmet and wrenched it forward. Sensing the danger, Yorfur snarled and shook himself as Lyra had seen Yorick shake himself at the water's edge, sending sheets of water flying high into the air. And Yorick fell away, dislodged, and with a screech of twisting metal, Yorfur stood up tall, straightening the steel of his back plates by sheer strength. Then, like an avalanche, he hurled himself down on Yorick, who was still trying to rise. Lyra felt her own breath knocked out of her by the force of that crashing fall. Certainly the very ground shook beneath her. How could Yorick survive that? He was struggling to twist himself and gain a purchase on the ground, but his feet were uppermost, and Yorfur had fixed his teeth somewhere near Yorick's throat. Drops of hot blood were flying through the air. One landed on Lyra's furs, and she pressed her hand to it like a token of love. Then Yorick's rear claws dug into the links of Yorfur's chainmail sark and ripped downward. The whole front came away, and Yorfur lurched sideways to look at the damage, leaving Yorick to scramble upright again. For a moment the two bears stood apart, getting their breath back. Yorfur was hampered now by that chainmail, because from a protection it had changed all at once into a hindrance. It was still fastened at the bottom and trailed around his rear legs. However, Yorick was worse off. He was bleeding freely from a wound at his neck and panting heavily. But he leapt at Yorfur before the king could disentangle himself from the clinging chainmail and knocked him head over heels, following up with a lunge at the bare part of Yorfur's neck where the edge of the helmet was bent. Yorfur threw him off, and then the two bears were at each other again, throwing up fountains of snow that sprayed in all directions and sometimes made it hard to see who had the advantage. Lyra watched, hardly daring to breathe, and squeezing her hands together so tight it hurt. She thought she saw Yorfur tearing at a wound in Yorick's belly, but that couldn't be right because a moment later, after another convulsive explosion of snow, both bears were standing upright like boxers, and Yorick was slashing with mighty claws at Yorfur's face, with Yorfur hitting back just as savagely. Lyra trembled at the weight of those blows, as if a giant were swinging a sledgehammer, and that hammer were armed with five steel spikes. Iron clanged on iron, teeth crashed on teeth, breath roared harshly, feet thundered on the hard-packed ground. The snow around was splashed with red and trodden down for yards into a crimson mud. Joffo's armour was in a pitiful state by this time, the plates torn and distorted, the gold inlay torn out or smeared thickly with blood, and his helmet gone altogether. Yorick's was in much better condition, for all its ugliness, dented but intact, standing up far better to the great sledgehammer blows of the Bear King, and turning aside those brutal 6-inch claws. But against that, Joffo was bigger and stronger than Yorick, and Yorick was weary and hungry, and had lost more blood. He was wounded in the belly, on both arms, and at the neck, whereas Joffo was bleeding only from his lower jaw. Lyra longed to help her dear friend, but what could she do? And it was going badly for Yorick now. He was limping. Every time he put his left forepaw on the ground, they could see that it hardly bore his weight. He never used it to strike with, and the blows from his right hand were feebler too, almost little pats compared with the mighty, crushing buffets he'd delivered only a few minutes before. Joffo had noticed. He began to taunt Yorick, calling him Broken Hand, Whimpering Cub, Rust-Eaten, Soon to Die, and other names, all the while swinging blows at him from right and left which Yorick could no longer parry. Yorick had to move backwards, a step at a time, and to crouch low under the rain of blows from the jeering Bear King. Lyra was in tears. Her dear, her brave one, her fearless defender was going to die, and she would not do him the treachery of looking away. For if he looked at her, he must see her shining eyes and their love and belief, not a face hidden in cowardice or a shoulder fearfully turned away. So she looked, but her tears kept her from seeing what was really happening, and perhaps it would not have been visible to her anyway. It certainly was not seen by Joffo. Because Yorick was moving backwards only to find clean, dry footing and a firm rock to leap up from, and the useless left arm was really fresh and strong. You could not trick a bear. But, as Lyra had shown him, Joffo did not want to be a bear, he wanted to be a man. And Yorick was tricking him. At last he found what he wanted, a firm rock deep anchored in the permafrost. He backed against it, tensing his legs and choosing his moment. It came when Joffo reared high above, bellowing his triumph and turning his head tauntingly towards Yorick's apparently weak left side. That was when Yorick moved. Like a wave that has been building its strength over 1,000 miles of ocean, and which makes little stir in the deep water, but which when it reaches the shallows rears itself up high into the sky, terrifying the shore dwellers, before crashing down on the land with irresistible power. So Yorick Birnison rose up against Joffo, exploding upwards from his firm footing on the dry rock and slashing with a ferocious left hand at the exposed jaw of Joffo Ragnarsson. It was a horrifying blow. It tore the lower part of his jaw clean off, so that it flew through the air, scattering blood drops in the snow many yards away. Joffo's red tongue lolled down, dripping over his open throat. The Bear King was suddenly voiceless, biteless, helpless. Yorick needed nothing more. He lunged, and then his teeth were in Joffo's throat, and he shook and shook, this way, that way, lifting the huge body off the ground and battering it down as if Joffo were no more than a seal at the water's edge. Then he ripped upwards, and Joffo Ragnarsson's life came away in his teeth. There was one ritual yet to perform. Yorick sliced open the dead king's unprotected chest, peeling the fur back to expose the narrow white and red ribs like the timbers of an upturned boat. Into the rib cage Yorick reached, and he plucked out Joffo's heart, red and steaming, and ate it there in front of Joffo's subjects. Then there was acclamation, pandemonium, a crush of bears surging forwards to pay homage to Joffo's conqueror. Yorick Birnison's voice rose above the clamour.
Bears! Who is your king?
And the cry came back in a roar like that of all the sea-smooth pebbles in the world in an ocean-battering storm.
Yorick Birnison!
The bears knew what they must do. Every single badge and sash and coronet was thrown off at once and trampled contemptuously underfoot, to be forgotten in a moment. They were Yorick's bears now, and true bears, not uncertain semi-humans conscious only of a torturing inferiority. They swarmed to the palace and began to hurl great blocks of marble from the topmost towers, rocking the battlemented walls with their mighty fists until the stones came loose, and then hurling them over the cliffs to crash on the jetty hundreds of feet below. Yorick ignored them and unhooked his armour to attend to his wounds, but before he could begin, Lyra was beside him, stamping her foot on the frozen scarlet snow and shouting to the bears to stop smashing the palace because there were prisoners inside. They didn't hear, but Yorick did, and when he roared, they stopped at once.
Human prisoners?
Yes! Joffo Ragnarsson put them in the dungeons! They ought to come out first and get shelter somewhere, else they'll be killed with all the falling rocks.
Yorick gave swift orders, and some bears hurried into the palace to release the prisoners. Lyra turned to Yorick.
Let me help you. I want to make sure you ain't too badly hurt, Yorick dear. Oh, I wish there were some bandages or something. That's an awful cut on your belly.
A bear laid a mouthful of some stiff green stuff, thickly frosted, on the ground at Yorick's feet.
Blood moss. Press it in the wounds for me, Lyra. Fold the flesh over it, and then hold some snow there till it freezes.
He wouldn't let any bears attend to him, despite their eagerness. Besides, Lyra's hands were deft, and she was desperate to help. So the small human bent over the great bear king, packing in the blood moss and freezing the raw flesh till it stopped bleeding. When she had finished, her mittens were sodden with Yorick's blood, but his wounds were staunched. And by that time the prisoners, a dozen or so men shivering and blinking and huddling together, had come out. There was no point in talking to the professor, Lyra decided, because the poor man was mad, and she would have liked to know who the other men were, but there were many other urgent things to do. And she didn't want to distract Yorick, who was giving rapid orders and sending bears scurrying this way and that, but she was anxious about Roger and about Lee Scoresby and the witches, and she was hungry and tired. She thought the best thing she could do just then was to keep out of the way. So she curled up in a quiet corner of the combat ground with Pantalaimon as a wolverine to keep her warm, and piled snow over herself as a bear would do, and went to sleep. Something nudged Lyra's foot, and a strange bear voice said,
Lyra Silvertongue, the king wants you.
She woke up nearly dead with cold and couldn't open her eyes for they had frozen shut. But Pantalaimon licked them to melt the ice on her eyelashes, and soon she was able to see the young bear speaking to her in the moonlight. She tried to stand but fell over twice. The bear said,
Ride on me,
and crouched to offer his broad back. And half clinging, half falling, she managed to stay on while he took her to a steep hollow, where many bears were assembled. And among them was a small figure who ran towards her, and whose demon leaped up to greet Pantalaimon.
Roger!
Yorick Bernison made me stay out there in the snow while he came to fetch you away. We fell out the balloon, Lyra! After you fell out, we got carried miles and miles, and then Mr. Scoresby let some more gas out, and we crashed into a mountain, and we fell down such a slope like you've never seen. And I don't know where Mr. Scoresby is now, nor the witches. There was just me and Yorick Bernison. He'd come straight back this way to look for you, and they told me about his fight.
Lyra looked around. Under the direction of an older bear, the human prisoners were building a shelter out of driftwood and scraps of canvas. They seemed pleased to have some work to do. One of them was striking a flint to light a fire.
There is food,
said the young bear who had woken Lyra. A fresh seal lay on the snow. The bear sliced it open with a claw and showed Lyra where to find the kidneys. She ate one raw. It was warm and soft and delicious beyond imagining.
Eat the blubber too,
said the bear, and tore off a piece for her. It tasted of cream flavoured with hazelnuts. Roger hesitated but followed her example. They ate greedily, and within a very few minutes Lyra was fully awake and beginning to be warm. Wiping her mouth, she looked around, but Yorick was not in sight.
Yorick Bjørnason is speaking with his counsellors,
said the young bear.
He wants to see you when you have eaten. Follow me.
He led them over a rise in the snow to a spot where bears were beginning to build a wall of ice blocks. Yorick sat at the centre of a group of older bears, and he rose to greet her.
Lyra Silvertongue, come and hear what I am being told.
He didn't explain her presence to the other bears, or perhaps they had learned about her already, but they made room for her and treated her with immense courtesy as if she were a queen. She felt proud beyond measure to sit beside her friend Yorick Bjørnason under the aurora as it flickered gracefully in the polar sky, and join the conversation of the bears. It turned out that Jofur Ragnarsson's dominance over them had been like a spell. Some of them put it down to the influence of Mrs. Coulter, who had visited him before Yorick's exile, though Yorick had not known about it, and given Jofur various presents.
She gave him a drug,
said one bear,
which he fed secretly to Hjalmar Hjalmarsson and made him forget himself.
Hjalmar Hjalmarsson, Lyra gathered, was the bear whom Yorick had killed and whose death had brought about his exile. So Mrs. Coulter was behind that. And there was more.
There are human laws that prevent certain things that she was planning to do. But human laws don't apply on Svalbard. She wanted to set up another station here like Bolvanger, only worse. And Jofur was going to allow her to do it against all the custom of the bears. Because humans have visited or been imprisoned, but never lived and worked here. Little by little she was going to increase her power over Jofur Ragnarsson and his over us, until we were her creatures running back and forth at her bidding, and our only duty to guard the abomination she was going to create.
That was an old bear speaking. His name was Søren Isersson, and he was a counsellor, one who had suffered under Jofur Ragnarsson.
"What is she doing now, Lyra?"
said Jorek Birnison.
"When she hears of Jofur's death, what will her plans be?"
Lyra took out the alethiometer. There was not much light to see it by, and Jorek commanded that a torch be brought.
"What happened to Mr. Scoresby?"
Lyra said while they were waiting.
"And the witches?"
"The witches were attacked by another witch clan. I don't know if the others were allied to the child cutters, but they were patrolling our skies in vast numbers, and they attacked in the storm. I didn't see what happened to Serafina Pecola. As for Lee Scoresby, the balloon soared up again after I fell out with the boy, taking him with it. But your symbol reader will tell you what their fate is."
A bear pulled up a sledge on which a cauldron of charcoal was smouldering, and thrust a resinous branch into the heart of it. The branch caught at once, and in its glare Lyra turned the hands of the alethiometer and asked about Lee Scoresby. It turned out that he was still aloft, borne by the winds towards Nova Zembla, and that he had been unharmed by the cliff ghasts and had fought off the other witch clan. Lyra told Jorek, and he nodded, satisfied.
"If he is in the air, he will be safe. What of Mrs. Coulter?"
The answer was complicated, with the needle swinging from symbol to symbol in a sequence that made Lyra puzzle for a long time. The bears were curious, but restrained by their respect for Jorek Birnison and his for Lyra, and she put them out of her mind and sank again into the alethiometric trance. The play of symbols, once she had discovered the pattern of it, was dismaying.
"It says she's heard about us flying this way, and she's got a transport zeppelin that's armed with machine guns. I think that's it. And they're flying to Svalbard right now. She don't know yet about Jofur Ragnarsson being beaten, of course, but she will soon because... Oh, yes, because the witches will tell her, and they'll learn it from the cliff ghasts. So I reckon there are spies in the air all around, Jorik. She was coming to pretend to help Jofur Ragnarsson, but really she was going to take over power from him with a regiment of Tartars that's a-coming by sea. And they'll be here in a couple of days. And as soon as she can, she's going to where Lord Asriel is kept prisoner. And she's intending to have him killed. Because it's coming clear now. Something I never understood before, Jorik. It's why she wants to kill Lord Asriel. It's because she knows what he's going to do, and she fears it. And she wants to do it herself and gain control before he does. It must be the city in the sky. It must be. She's trying to get to it first. And now it's telling me something else.
She bent over the instrument, concentrating furiously as the needle darted this way and that. It moved almost too fast to follow. Roger, looking over her shoulder, couldn't even see it stop, and was conscious only of a swift, flickering dialogue between Lyra's fingers turning the hands and the needle answering, as bewilderingly unlike language as the Aurora was.
"Yes,"
she said finally, putting the instrument down in her lap and blinking and sighing as she woke out of her profound concentration.
"Yes, I see what it says. She's after me again. She wants something I've got, because Lord Asriel wants it too. They need it for this experiment, whatever it is."
She stopped there to take a deep breath. Something was troubling her, and she didn't know what it was. She was sure that this something that was so important was the alethiometer itself, because after all, Mrs. Coulter had wanted it, and what else could it be? And yet it wasn't, because the alethiometer had a different way of referring to itself, and this wasn't it.
"I suppose it's the alethiometer. It's what I thought all along. I've got to take it to Lord Asriel before she gets it. If she gets it, we'll all die."
As she said that, she felt so tired, so bone-deep weary and sad, that to die would have been a relief. But the example of Yorick kept her from admitting it. She put the alethiometer away and sat up straight.
How far away is she?
Just a few hours. I suppose I ought to take the alethiometer to Lord Asriel as soon as I can.
I will go with you.
She didn't argue. While Yorick gave commands and organized an armed squad to accompany them on the final part of their journey north, Lyra sat still, conserving her energy. She felt that something had gone out of her during that last reading. She closed her eyes and slept, and presently they woke her and set off.